Welcome to the Design the Future podcast, where we talk with women leading the way towards a better built world. Design the Future is hosted by me, Lindsay Baker, with Kira Gould. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Design the Future podcast. It's good to be with you. This is Lindsay.
And this is Kira.
And here we are for another lovely week. I'm excited to be here with you as always, Kira. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm enjoying springtime, which is really fun after winter. It's a totally different thing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. This is your first springtime after winter since you moved back to a place that has those things.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
15 years in California. And so it's really exciting. The flowers are busting out and it's just so fun. I'm really enjoying it.
Yay. Oh, I'm happy for you and jealous. And yeah, but I guess that's just how it feels, the grass being greener. And
that's right. Literally greener.
literally greener there. Yeah. Meanwhile, we are still holding our breath here in California for the end of the rainy season, and the roads are still washing out, and it's still, still feels like our winter in some ways. It's bizarre. But that's the world these days for you. But I'm glad you're getting springtime. That's lovely.
Nice. It's great. Enjoying
that's
it.
Good.
And getting ready, gearing up for a lot of conferencing this spring, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
So
I'm excited that you're coming to Living Future. And for folks that don't know, Kira's going to be on the main stage at Living Future this year. I'm very excited about this, Kira. I hope I'm allowed to say a little bit, but it's because for those that listen to the podcast, you know that Kira cares a lot about the words that we use to describe concepts in our community and in our profession, and sort of like the ways that those words do or don't help us to do our work. And I don't know, Kira, is it too much of a spoiler to say that you're going to talk about that at Living Future?
Not at all. I'm right in the middle of working on that, and it's very exciting. And yes, anyone who's listened to the podcast knows that I have strong opinions about this. So, and I'm sure not everyone will agree with them, but I hope it will be a fun talk and that it will lead to some really interesting conversations. And I cannot wait to be at Living Future again. It's been a while since I've been to this amazing conference. So I cannot wait.
Yay. Yeah, I'm so
in Atlanta.
So I know, Atlanta, Georgia. For folks who may be in the South, this is your time. I'm so excited that we're bringing it to Atlanta. I just heard about all the like wonderful music that's like Atlanta bands that are going to be playing at the conference, and all the spots that we're going to go to that have, you know, wonderful like vegan soul food. Hopefully some of you are fans of vegan soul food. I am. So it should be fun.
I think it's true. It really is having that effect too. One of my clients has an office in Birmingham, and they're bringing several people to the event, which I'm very excited about. So it's really, I think people are really stoked to have it in a region that it's never been in before.
Yeah. It's fun. I think it also really speaks to, I don't know. I'm just excited because for folks that know Living Future anyway, but I think this is true even more broadly of our community. I think we don't talk enough about what's happening in the South. I think like there's just incredible innovation and work and sort of community oriented structures that have been created there. And I think we'll do an okay job of making sure that those are highlighted. I wish there was more we could do, but I don't know. I'm just ready for the Southeast to get a little bit of that like spotlight.
Absolutely.
It'll be fun.
Couldn't agree more. No, it's totally true. 100%. There's so much. There is a lot happening in the Southeast, which I think some people are just really even aren't aware of it. And it also happens sometimes in a different way than in other regions. So there's a lot to learn from how they talk about it, how they execute, what advocacy looks like in that region, all kinds of stuff. It's super exciting.
Yeah. And a lot of former podcast guests will be speaking about things. I also just want to mention for folks, just because it's inspiring to me, that Heather McTiratoni is going to be our main keynote speaker for the conference. And if you don't know Heather and her work, working on environmental justice issues, especially, specifically in the Southeast, you should look her up. She's incredible. She's written some books that are wonderful. And I think it'll be really inspiring just to hear about her work and what she's doing now.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And speaking of someone very inspiring that we get to hear from and who spoke at Living Future last year, I am very excited that we have finally managed to bring our next guest to the podcast. So today on the podcast, we have Alyssa Amor Gibbons. Welcome to the podcast, Alyssa Amor.
Thank you so much, guys. It's really nice to be here. So thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. We are delighted and honored. And so I'm going to share a little bit about Alyssa Amor. I'm going to give her bio, but I also want to just start off by saying that I first learned about her through her TED Talk, which you can go and find on the TED website. She did like the real, real TED, like full on. And it's a beautiful TED Talk. And then I asked her to come be with us last year at Living Future in Washington, D.C., where she talked about her work there. So it is high time that we have her on the podcast to talk a little bit more in dialogue with us about her work. But so for those that have not yet learned about her, here are the basics. Alyssa Amor calls herself an Arketeer, by which she means a designer of environmentally conscious, energy efficient, and resilient architecture. Architecture that reflects a deep reverence for nature and our interconnectedness with the world. She has degrees in structural engineering and architecture and specializes in building information modeling. She also works as an advisor for the Spinnaker Group, which is a division of Socotec, with special consideration to the sustainable certification of buildings in hot and humid climates. So, Alyssa Amor, we would love for you to start off by just telling us a little bit about you. So we'd like to learn about how and why you got involved in design and resilience. So tell us a little bit about your path.
Thank you, Lindsay. So for those who don't know or can't tell from my accent, I'm from Barbados, which is a small island in the middle of I consider in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but we are neighbored on the west by the Caribbean Sea. But I was born there, I grew up there, I lived there, I worked from there. And a lot of who I am as a person is kind of based on the culture that I grew up in. You know, literally an island girl who grew up, you know, underwater for most of it, you know, running around barefoot in between the palings, you know, picking tamarinds and coconuts and mangoes and, you know, just an island girl through and through. And, you know, growing up on an island, you know, we're less than 300,000 people, about 260,000 now, 166 square miles, you know, beautiful beaches, is really hard not to notice how important nature is and how big it is compared to the small part that you play, you know, just by inhabiting Earth. So a lot of my passion for design and creation and art and architecture really came from this influence of just trying to be a good piece to this really big puzzle that I saw in my mind. You know, getting into resilience, I grew up on an island that has hurricanes or storms, you know, typical tropical weather. And there's this real understanding as well growing up that you're vulnerable and at the mercy of nature. And we've been very lucky as an island to not suffer as heavily as some of our neighboring islands have, but it's very much this kind of overarching, impending understanding that at any given time, you could be faced with a natural event that could drastically change your future and, you know, your current livelihood. It could cost your life. So understanding all of that, getting into architecture and design, seeing the real impacts of climate change and the issues that we face as a small nation as well, I don't need to look at statistics to kind of encourage me to do better, you know, because you look around and you see it. The coral reefs that I used to, you know, dive and see when I was a little girl, they look totally different. The beaches, they're looking totally different. Anywhere you look, Even if you step outside and you feel the difference in temperature, there's this understanding that things are in a state of flux. And there are things that I am doing as a human that can impact that. And my passion for architecture really comes from that understanding that I can design or do better for myself, for my communities, and really just wanting to tie all of that into, the work that I do on a day-to-day basis.
I love that. It's a great background story. And I think it's so intriguing too to have that sense of weather and the vulnerability to nature as being sort of a part of what drove you to design and resilience. I'm wondering what advice you have for people who are interested in taking a path that's similar to yours.
I always encourage people to question what their passions are, what their natural curiosities are. I truly believe that the really great work comes from people doing the things that they were meant to do and really tapping into those kind of life purposes, those life walks, not to sound cheesy, but I think everyone kind of has a sense of fulfillment when they do certain things. And I would always encourage people to follow those curiosities and follow those passions. It doesn't have to look like anyone else's career path or trajectory. It really can be just from you being, quite frankly, quasi-obsessed with a particular thing, and you're the one that has to do the research, and you're the one that has to fall in love with the problem, because only you might be the one that connects the dots and comes up with the solution to make it better. So I'd encourage people to really sit with yourself and ask what do you want to contribute? Like why are you here in this time, in this era, and what do you want to leave as a legacy? Was your life's work?
That's powerful advice, honestly. And it's so interesting. I think, imagine if everybody did that instead of just sort of proceeding along the paths that the more conventional paths that appear before us. So I'd like to shift a little bit to your work. Can you tell us what you're most proud of accomplishing in your work life?
It's always a hard question for me because I always feel like I'm not doing enough. But I think what I'm most proud of is the kind of mindset that I've started to adopt. I'm multi-passionate. There are a lot of things that pull me in different directions, and I always want to try to understand where the synergies and how they overlap. I'm really proud of the fact that, and this is only within the last year or two, where I feel a sense of conviction and almost compulsion to do what I'm doing now. I didn't always feel as sure about myself, admittedly, but I think having this multidisciplinary background, in engineering, in design, in architecture, really trying to venerate my cultural heritage and understanding, what are the unique viewpoints that I can bring to the design table. Really starting to embrace that is something that I'm proud of now. And working within the space of sustainability and resilience, while it can be at times super technical and, quite rigid in terms of aiming for certain benchmarks and metrics, I'm proud of the fact that I still have found a way to craft a career path of my own design and give myself the freedom of thought and creativity to dream really, really big. A lot of the stuff that I'm working on now and hope to work on throughout the rest of my career is really driven by this understanding that there are huge problems that we have to fix as humans, as a people, specifically small island developing nations or lesser developed countries. There are issues to be solved, but I don't think you have to stop dreaming to solve them. And I think I've started to hit my stride in terms of doing the really difficult work, but also leaving space to create new things and alternative ways and really bold ways of considering how do we design ourselves out of some of the issues that we do face.
I really, that just, I think that is so powerful, especially the connection that you're making between the passion, the technical work, and also your cultural heritage. I think it really comes through in what you're doing now. And I find that the connections that you're able to make there are what I think are so inspiring. You know, in your TED Talk, you talk about architecture for survivability through disaster, extreme weather events. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Yeah, of course. So in 2017, there were, well, over the years, of course, several systems passed through the Caribbean region. Barbados is usually very, very, very lucky in that we sit the most easterly of all the islands. So we kind of sit outside of the island belts. We're on a different tectonic plate. Oftentimes, a lot of the systems don't form or are not as well developed as they kind of pass us and then, you know, intensify to do a lot more damage to other islands. People always joke, you know, God must be a Bajan, but I think every country thinks thinks that they might be the lucky ones, right? But there was a period of time around 2017, I was working in St. Kitts at the time on a large project over there, and there were some systems that passed through while I was on site. And we sheltered, of course. We were lucky on the island, but some of the neighboring smaller islands were, you know, pretty much flattened. And then quite quickly after that, Hurricane Maria passed through and absolutely devastated Dominica. And then, of course, after that, you know, of Dorian and Bahamas. But Maria was the one that really kind of dragged me into figuring out what does post-disaster recovery and rebuilding look like for countries like my own. After Maria, I was quite literally put on a plane and flew over to meet with some clients who wanted to rebuild. And I distinctly remember flying over, about to land at the airport, and just looking at the terrain and being so confused, because Dominica is quite lush. Is a super beautiful island, lots of fruit trees, a lot of flora. And I remember trying to get my bearings because there was no green, but everywhere on the hillside as we were landing, it looked like matchsticks that were just like pushed over. Like if someone maybe had like a really thin domino, you know how people set up like the domino patterns and knocked them over? It looked like someone had gone, you know, whoosh, and knocked a whole bunch of these sticks over. And I remember looking and looking and looking. And as you get closer, the pattern starts to reveal itself. And just before we landed, I realized what it was. It was all the trees. All of the trees were knocked over and absolutely stripped of all of their leaves. So what before would have been this beautiful forested environment and terrain was just barren. And that image will never ever leave my mind, because you could see everything. You could see where houses were gone. You could see where the tarpaulin, they give out like plastic covers to help people shelter under in tents. You could see the rows and rows of tents. You could see everything, just absolute devastation. And going there after that was a bit of a professional life changer for me. A lot of times in the Caribbean, there's a lot of development, mainly around hospitality, and less so, in my personal opinion, in terms of infrastructure development. And seeing people in really see their need and understanding that this is something beyond what I might have dealt with before. You know, even my client almost lost his life during that hurricane. And being there and walking the ground and walking the site and seeing how buildings were damaged, how they failed, which ones survived, which ones didn't. Walking the site with the client and seeing how the wind interacted with their specific site, and knowing that we couldn't let this happen again, or try it as best within our capabilities to avoid it. That really changed my outlook. We literally walked the site together. This wasn't send her a couple photos or Google Earth image and she could design it from where she was. It was, you're on a plane over here walking through the bush with me, like climbing over felled trees and deciding which ones we could salvage wood from, which ones we could turn into furniture. So understanding the site and the rebuilding efforts from that kind of firsthand point of view, I think kind of nudged me a little bit into a more convicted walk in terms of what I want to do as a career. Now, I already, being from an island, like I said, I already have that connection to nature, but understanding how you could leverage your skills to do better. People always say, build back better. And I don't want us to have to do that anymore. I want us to build better from the beginning. So that was the project that kind of sticks in my heart a little bit because it was the first time where I felt like from my thoughts to paper or my pen to drawing set, it really felt like what you're doing is really, really making a difference. Like right now, it's not this big long 2 years of a beautiful project and we bring in all these beautiful fittings and finishes. It was, we need a roof over our heads. We want to get this property back up and running. We want to be good again. So I enjoyed the chance to grow as a person through that experience, albeit from really tough circumstances for all of those affected. But I think having that perspective really shaped something new inside of me.
That's such an important story. It's also so, I don't know, just listening to that makes me think about, I don't know, it's a hard thing to say, but how probably more of us will have that kind of experience in the coming years, of
Oh,
like
yeah.
of walking and deciding what to salvage and use on a landscape where things have broken, things have been destroyed. But I love this point about not focusing on building back better, but trying to really, build so that we have that resilience. Well, tell us a little bit about how things have grown for you since then. So what are you thinking about and working on at the moment?
Yeah, so I do a lot of work right now. Well, there are a couple of hats I wear. I tend to have my fingers in a bunch of different pots, but I do design work, yes. I do quite a bit of residential work, actually, but also some civic and urban scale projects. And of course, I do sustainability work. I think that's kind of the core of what I do, whether it be design or certification, like I do with Sokotech, who's been an amazing family who took me on after I left my previous employment. I really wanted to define for myself the type of work I wanted to do. I joined the Spinnaker team and then we got acquired by Sokotech. So now I do quite a bit of work in, testing and verification and lead and well consulting for, I'd say, hot and humid climates. So not just for the South Florida region, but hoping to do some really amazing projects in the Caribbean region as well. But from a design point of view, as we think about designing for the future, for me, a lot of my work now is really within that dreaming space. So before I talked about, the technical work, which is, hitting those benchmarks, those metrics, the ASG reporting. But there's also this space that I feel equally enthused by, and it's this idea of dreaming and self-actualization, but not just at an individual scale, but at a community scale. So what does it look like if not just our homes? Well, first of all, we need to have enough homes, which we don't have in Barbados. But apart from just fulfilling those basic needs, like the right to human shelter, what if while we do that, we can create the spaces that our kids dream in, that people go to plan their life and the opportunities at a community scale? That's what I'm so passionate about as well. And I do a lot of kind of conceptual or schematic urban interventions. I do a lot of work in terms of kind of cultural and heritage workshops and public participatory charrettes. Right now, I recently founded a company called Future City, and we are sort of bridging the gap between urban design, civic tech, and fintech. So, as someone from a lesser developed country, as they called it, where we used to be referred to as third world countries, there's a huge disparity between one financial empowerment and just economic generation. I think in most countries, 80% of the GDP comes from cities, but that hasn't been the case in countries like mine. One, we face huge issues due to climate mitigation efforts and a huge lack of investment to make the necessary changes to adapt and be safe as a coastal city, quite frankly, a coastal country. That's very important to just be able to make the necessary changes to be able to handle the issues that we're facing. But also from the point of view that whether people like to talk about it or would rather not talk about it, as countries like my own, we all have this colonial legacy that even centuries later, we're still trying to overcome. You know, Barbados is 50 something years old, where other countries measure their age in, you know, centuries, thousands of years, AD. And before Christ, BC, we are 50 something years old, 55, I believe. We're young and we're still trying to find our footing off the back of urban infrastructure and developments that weren't meant for the benefit of people. It was all about trade, trade of bodies, trade of goods, but not for leisure, not for enjoyment, not for prosperity and development. So, taking a lot of the work that I've done in how do you rebuild places that have either suffered devastation or just need to be optimized in terms of spatial layouts and kind of leveraging the emergent technologies, leveraging AI, leveraging digital twin construction to start to build virtual worlds where we can test and simulate some of the ideas. We can test zoning, we can test building performance, and we can make decisions ahead of time across different variables without having to invest the money upfront to do that. So that when we do, you know, execute these projects, that we're doing so as efficiently as possible. So Future City is doing just that. We've been leveraging AI conversational tools to talk to as many citizens as possible and identifying trends in perception, understanding gaps in services within the city. For example, one project that I'm working on right now is the second largest building in the city. And, you know, between the hours of 2 to 3, you have hundreds to thousands of school kids walking past. And does that mean that that building should become an after-school event center? Or does it need to be sold to the highest bidder as a hotel? Those are the kinds of conversations that I want to have now, where we can do better for more people. Can we do better for the biggest demographic of people, or do we have to be constrained to the financial issues that we've had in the past? I want to see us grow as a country, as a nation. I want to, yes, ensure that we have adequate housing, yes, to ensure that we are resilient, but I also want us to create space and leverage technology to identify the opportunities that we either haven't had the money to address, or no one has sat down and thought about the what if. What if we can do all of these things at the same time? You know? So that's
Yeah.
where I am right now, just working really hard at that nexus between solving all of the difficult issues that we know we have, but also looking to new opportunities to figure out how do we inhabit our space in a way that allows us to grow as a nation, to aspire.
And I just love this point about how so much of our world has been shaped by trade rather than by thriving, like human thriving and what it means. I think even, I just don't know that a lot of people have opened their eyes to that quite yet. And the more you start to see the ways that our world was shaped that way, the more excited I think you will get about the way that you're approaching these questions, you know, because I mean, even then, I don't know, it's just really fun to hear you talk about AI and the way that you think about using it. So I don't get excited about AI very much, but I do really get excited about the way that it's a part of your considerations for the future. Just, I mean, it's like anything, right? The tool is how it is not valuable in of itself, but how you use it really is. And this feels like a great use for it. So yeah, that's exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, I think with AI is like, it could be scary, but there's also opportunity in the unknown as well. And I think because of this kind of influx of discourse around AI, I think from my perspective, I would anticipate a huge pushback in terms of humanity being a theme that people really try to hold on to. So you have this machine learning and this artificial intelligence. And I think the kind of repercussion of that is that we may see a development in kind of group thinking around who are we as humans, because you're kind of faced with this almost antithesis to everything you think makes you a unique individual. So I think there's going to be this trend of thinking, how do we hold on to humanity, because AI is going to continue to develop, you know?
Totally agree. I am fascinated with AI, and I'm currently in a little bit of a spinning place about it. But I think there's so much potential. I love hearing this. I didn't really know that this was part of your work. And I think there is so much opportunity, especially if we can be more clear about what we want it to do for us and then help us accelerate. I think that's where I really see the potential.
For sure.
If as long as we can hold, you know, be really also cognizant of holding on to the humanity at the same time and being really intentional about that. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for bringing that up. It's really interesting.
Welcome.
I want to shift gears just a little bit. We like to sort of zoom out and talk about a little bit sort of more about the sphere and the larger world in which you operate and we operate, all of us. And I'm just curious if you feel like you're part of an industry or a part of a movement, or how do you think about those things for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a rebel. So I sometimes struggle to feel like I fit into any given movement. But I think I do in some ways, and I don't in other ways. And I'll try to explain as best I could. I mentioned the company that I work for. I do some sustainability analysis with Socotec, and my team is amazing. I mean, I work with people from Pakistan to persons who worked in Tahiti, Venezuela, South Florida, me from Barbados. Is this amazing international team. And I look to my left and I look to my right, or on the Zoom calls, and I see all of these people who are equally as passionate about making a difference. And we've all found, you know, our burden to bear, and we've picked it up and we're running with it. We're doing, you know, the work, the gritty work, the documentation, you guys know, the kind of really strict analysis and certification and hitting benchmarks and having the conversations with clients and manufacturers and GCs to make this all work. In that way, 100%, I feel part of this bigger entity that is within the kind of testing and verification and certification world, where we are actively doing things to make a difference. But coming from myself as a Bajan in the global south, I also see the difference between the kind of mandated and legislative requirements that larger countries have implemented. And I see the challenges and the issues that we face in just having adequate building stock for the people that we do have. So in that regard, when I kind of put on my unique lens as Alyssa from Barbados, I don't always feel like I'm part of a movement outside of my country or region or people who live in similar circumstances that I grew up in, right? There's, and I don't want to offend anybody, y'all. This coming from a good place, but working both locally and globally, I do feel sometimes that even having the conversation around sustainability and resilience is a luxury, because for some people, that's not their immediate need. Their immediate need is to survive either the next natural event or their circumstances. And truly, the broader conversations, whether they come from, a good place, whether it's a bleeding heart, whether it's just the hot topic, it is a luxury. In my country, up until last year, the water turns off at certain times because we don't have a lot of water. We don't have natural, like, surface level water. We're an incredibly water scarce country. We're food scarce as well. We depend on everything coming from the outside in. So we're so vulnerable to all the fluctuations in global markets, etc. So while we might be very impacted by a lot of the issues that are up for discussion when it comes to climate, it may not always be the absolute immediate first need that we need to address, right? So understanding that for some of us that sustainability and resilience are interchangeable really kind of takes us sometimes out of that almost desktop discussion about what sustainability should be. That does not mean that I am a Debbie Downer about it or that I don't have any hope, but it is a distinct reality for me working across two different regions where I understand that sometimes, as well-meaning as we might be, there are huge underlying issues that kind of cripple you in addressing issues the way that you would love to, but you can't quite as yet. So I would love to see, and I hope that my work can start to bridge the gap. And I mean, there are amazing proposals and just kind of thought pieces on how we can bridge that gap. I mean, if you take a look at the Bridgetown Initiative and the whole proposal for kind of changing the game plan for climate finance, and even some of the work that we're doing with Future City, creating a network of resilient cities throughout the global south and really opening up new financial models for equity within ownership of physical space, so that we can lift people out of poverty in one generation or less. Like, really starting to think about, okay, we don't have huge access to financial means, but what we do have are loads of problems to solve. And out of that kind of problem-solving mentality must come solutions, even if by force. Necessity is the mother of invention. Even if just that, the ability to look at all of these issues that we are trying to solve at the same time with minimum resources, there must be some kind of ingenuity that comes out of that. And I would love to continue to, and I hope my work and everything that I do and I stand for, I really hope that starts to make that movement that's specific to the most affected, that's specific to maybe the ones with less access. I really hope that encourages a lot more momentum and focus and eyes and resources to help us kind of somewhat catch up to the opportunities that might be elsewhere.
That is amazing. I'm so touched by that perspective. And it's hard for me to know if this is, I mean, I hope that we are understanding that much broader perspective of what sustainability is in various places and in various contexts. But yeah, that's just fascinating, your framing of it. And of course, nobody takes offense. It's not
Yeah,
offensive.
none
You
meant at
shouldn't,
all.
not at all. You shouldn't. I mean,
Yeah.
it's well, I mean, for one thing, it's absolutely true. And it's incredible. I mean, there is so much. I don't know. From my perspective, with a little bit of exposure, for example, to international conversations like at COP, for example, at the COP events, I do feel like there's a very great openness now to learning from the Global South, learning from island nations, and making sure that those kinds of considerations, which are not a part of how many Global North communities have been addressing or defining sustainability in the past. I think there's more of that, but that's just maybe my hopeful outsider perspective. I'm not sure. And so I'm curious too about where you thought we would be in this decade, for example, in the 2020s, you know, what the kind of arc that you're seeing. And you, it's fascinating to me because, of course, you're in touch with, I love that idea that you were on a Zoom with all those people all over the world, you know, that kind of stuff. That's fantastic. So how, where did you think we would be by this point as a movement? And I say movement now, trying to think of it in the terms that you were just describing, right? The really the global movement.
Man, I thought I would have been, you know, chilling somewhere. No need to work because we had everything figured out, you know. There was, I can't remember the name of the architect or the movement. I could picture it in my head, the kind of renders and the imagery, but I believe it was from a documentary called Zeitgeist. I could be wrong, but in that, there was a kind of architectural movement that was, it was very utopic, and it kind of gave this idea of, you know, AI and machines and robots kind of taking over the burden from us humans. And, you know, everybody was just living in bliss because, you know, there was no need. You know, there was no lack of anything. There was no need to clock long hours because it was more of like a barter system. Everything was taken care of. I think I thought as a kid that by this time we would be maybe a little more advanced in terms of just in terms of how our systems worked. I don't know if I had a kind of Jetson-esque idea in my head of the future, but I definitely don't think that this is where I thought we would be. If you listen to some of my talks, I could be a bit, maybe a bit satirical, but you know, we are putting people into space for leisure and we're figuring out a lot of other things. But then some of the very simple things that you thought should have been like priority one, we haven't yet. So I think in some ways that has been, I wouldn't say disappointing, but it's just been something that I have definitely paid attention to. Because I don't think we lack, you know, the intelligence or the capabilities or the tools to do certain things. I just think in general, sometimes our priorities lists could be a bit skewed collectively. But like I always say, it's not all doom and gloom. I'm so hopeful for the future. I think the direction that we are heading in globally is one that should be decided by all of us. Sadly, it's not. I don't know what it would take to make it possible, but I think in any conversation about sustainability as it relates to this big old rock that we're all sitting on, you know, it should be a conversation for everyone, not just defined by a few. And I definitely thought that by now, certain biases or prejudices would be changed, but they're not, you know, even after, particularly after my talk came out, the TED talk, there were, you know, there people leave comments and stuff, and I read most of them, if not all. And there was one in particular that stood out to me. And I always mention this because it really hurt. You know, someone basically said that they don't understand why people like us live in places like this that aren't meant to be lived in. Like, why not just move all of them to somewhere else? And I really wanted to reply, you know, is that open invitation to come live at your house? Because where am I gonna go? Like, this is where, I can't even say this is where I'm from. This is where my people were deposited, you know? So we're all playing the hand we've been dealt. Some of us have a better hand than others. Some of us have quite frankly cheated, but we're all at the same table trying to play this game, right? And I just hope for the future that even if we're not 100% there now, that we can get to a point where everybody is equally equipped to play the hand that they're dealt, right? Whether there needs to be some kind of restorative justice or reparations or just more seats at the table for people with different viewpoints that haven't been heard before and different pain points and different issues to have conversations that impact all of us. I think that's where I would like us to get to.
That feels so deeply reasonable, and also it does also hurt my heart that it somehow is so hard and so, yeah, like so hard for somebody like that commenter to get their heads around. I'm with you. I'm with you. Well, it is still inspiring and wonderful to hear those words. However, much work we have to do ahead to make them come into reality. We are almost out of time. I want to make sure we have time for our very last question. So, Alyssa Amora, tell us who or what you're most inspired by these days.
The hardest question yet. You guys know, you guys know how hard it can be sometimes just to stay, not motivated, that's the wrong word, just to stay up and open and positive with yourself. Sometimes I feel very stuck, like maybe I'm not doing enough, or maybe I could be doing more. What, maybe I need to think about it this way. You know, I really, really ruminate very deeply on things that I could probably just not, but it's just my personality, it's just who I am. I feel everything so deeply, and I really just try my absolute best. And the last couple of weeks have been tough because I, you know, sometimes you just feel like you're stuck in a bit of a rut. Maybe progress isn't happening as quickly, or you're just not getting forward with a project that you know is really important, but it just is moving so slowly. And I've been really struggling these last couple of weeks. But I'd say, to answer your question, this conversation actually has been a nice pause in, you know, in busy days and meetings to just reflect a bit and think about what really, you know, keeps me going and what matters to me. And as cheesy as it sounds, it always goes back to the ocean for me. Like, you know, everywhere I look, there's water, and there's great power in that, knowing that things could be calm one moment, but, you know, raging the next. But at the end of the day, it kind of all just settles back down. Whatever box you put it in or container you put it in, all this work that we do, it really just settles back down to its true essence. And I draw a lot of personal inspiration from that analogy. And I hope to, I just really, guys, I just really want to do good work. Like, I want to leave here knowing that, you know, I've done everything that was in my heart to do.
Oh, yeah. I love that. Yeah, the ocean. I have those moments with the ocean. There's just something about the way that it just like it's permanence, but that's not really the right word for it. But the strength, the source of strength for me as well. And I'm really glad to hear that having some time to reflect and to chat with us has been helpful. You mentioned something about feeling so deeply. It reminds me of Octavia Butler's books, and in particular the Earthseed trilogy and main character there, who's this hyper empath, and how she becomes the hero. And there's something very profound about the idea that when we feel deeply, when we are those people, it gives us a special strength and something that we give to the world, even though it can be really hard sometimes. So thank you for that. And thank you for being on the podcast. It has been a delight and an honor.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lindsay and Kira. This was much needed.
I agree. I agree. And okay, we are going to wrap up. So thank you, everyone. That is it for us this week on the Design the Future podcast. Thanks again for listening. Please leave us a review on Apple. It really matters. It helps people find us. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.